My name is Smitty, and I'm an alcoholic. And there is no place in the world I'd rather be right now than right here. And I mean that. That's just not word speak. I'm just grateful. And I've been grateful since I got stuck in traffic out there on the road coming in. And I thought it was an accident. And I said, Lord, whatever's going on with this accident, just please let whoever got hurt, let it not be serious. And all of a sudden, the traffic started moving. I roll up, and there my boy is hanging off the truck, you know, paving the road. I said, thank you, God. Thank you, God. But I'm grateful. I'm very thankful to be here tonight, and I'm grateful to be a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the incredibly unique things about this workshop, and I love this workshop, and it is because I can come in this place and I can call myself anything I want to call myself. And I don't have to worry about anybody coming up after me to try and correct me, to try to engage me, to try to instruct me on proper anonymous etiquette. Anybody ever had that happen to me before? I'll never forget one of the first meetings I went to out in Douglasville. I was the only person in that meeting that looked like me. You know, so I'm just saying, I was in that meeting and I said something in that meeting about some cocaine. And this little joker in some overalls came over after the meeting. He said, my son, we're glad to have you here tonight. Hope you come back. He said, but you can't come back in here talking about that cocaine. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he quoted a big book for about 2 minutes instructing me on proper Alcoholics Anonymous etiquette. And I respected that. I was also in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting one time, and I said something about my sobriety.
On the south side, you don't finish.
And this little fella came up to me after the meeting, and this time I probably had about 15, 16 years sober. He came up and he was instructing me on proper NA etiquette. And someone said, ask this cat how long he's been clean. I said, how long you been clean, man? 4 days. So what's so beautifully unique about this workshop and about the heavy hitters Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is that we read a statement in every heavy hitters meeting. And that statement says there's no alcoholic or addict ever need to be felt uncomfortable about saying whatever it is he wants to call himself, in essence. And, you know, and the fact that every group is autonomous except in matters affecting other groups, we get to set the tone and the tenor for that meeting. And I never forget when I first heard that, I was just like, this is it. This is it. And I know sometimes we get so hung up on our fellowships, man. I know about y'all NA Nazis. I know about the AA Nazis. You know, in CA, we just don't care, man. But that's the beauty of what we do, man. At the end of the day, I just want to know if you've not drank any booze, if you've not smoked any cocaine, and if you've not done any mind-altering substances. If you haven't done that, man, it's all good, you know. And so I have some pretty good ideas about what I would like to have seen, you know, in my first 30 days. Sober, clean, and my sponsor said, listen, I know you got some great ideas, but the best one you have had you over on Peter Street trying to pawn a salt and pepper shaker. So I'll tell you about that a little later. But so for right now, Mr. Mohouse, just, you know, we got a book here. It's got a great program in it. They've been doing this since 1935. It's 1988. You're going to be okay, you know. And so I'm a product of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. I'm a product of the Narcotics Anonymous program. I'm a product of the Cocaine Anonymous program. And at the end of the day and at the end of each one of those meetings, they hand out the same chips. They hand out, you know, the key tags, whatever you want to call it. But we recognize each other's clean, sober time. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful and thankful that I have a seat in every one of those fellowships, but tonight is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I'm going to try my best to contain my comments to those of alcohol as best I can one day at a time. My sobriety date is 11/21/1988. I just celebrated 28 years sober in November. Yeah. And I used to, you know, one of my sponsors said, you know, you never have to apologize for how much time you have. You go to a meeting, you feel guilty about saying how much time you have. You don't have to apologize for how much time you have. People need to hear that. Mm-hmm. We hear enough about relapses. We need to hear about people who are sticking and staying.
That's right.
And so not only have I been sober for 28 years, I also turned 56 years old this past July. So I've been sober half my life. Mm-hmm. I've been sober half my life. And it's been pretty incredible. I'm an Atlanta native. I'm a Grady baby. And I've been in Atlanta all my life. I drank booze up and down I-20. I drank booze outside of 285, inside of 285. I drank booze while driving around 285. So I know that town, and it's my town, and I did a lot of damage. I'm just a drunk and a crackhead from the west side of Atlanta. And I grew up in the Adamsville area. And I did a lot over on that side of town. And when I drive through that now, you know, I look at all the places that I used to drink. And sometimes my son would be in the car with me when he was growing up. And I would tell him, I said, boy, Daddy used to, right there. And Daddy used to, he said, Dad, is there any place in Atlanta you didn't get high? I said, not many. Not many. But I'm grateful because the life I lead today is unimaginable. Alvin used to tell me all the time, he said, Smith, if you keep coming, you're going to live a life beyond your wildest imagination. Your wildest imagination. At the time, my wildest imagination included Sanaa Lathan, a barrel of cocaine, a barrel of Jack Daniels, and a bucket full of Crystal hamburgers. That was my wildest imagination right there. And, you know, that was it. But what I did not know is that I was going to find a fellowship of men and women who were going to teach me one day at a time that I didn't have to drink. And that I was going to live a life beyond my wildest imaginations. My mother-in-law, in our cabin meeting, I heard a couple guys talking about how their lives are kind of changing right now because they find themselves in situations where they're having to take care of their parents now. My biological parents are deceased, but my in-laws right now are under my wife's and my care. And my mother-in-law is in the first stages of Alzheimer's, and educator, incredible woman, and now I find myself in a position where we're taking care of her now. This is a woman who, when I was dating her daughter, the last few years of my using, tried to tell her daughter, don't marry this dude. Whatever you do, don't marry this dude. And my wife was all excited about the relationship. She said, oh, mama, it's just magical. It's just, oh, my gosh, he's just magical. He's magical. She said, oh, yeah, he's quite the magician. She said, because every time he's over here, something else disappears. And so, but what I'm telling you is that don't marry this guy. Because her mother saw something in me that she did not like. And now this is the same woman who now trusts me with everything that she has. And I drive her around in her beautiful CTS Cadillac. And I take her to her doctor's appointments. And I control her checking account. And she's doing good. She's doing real well. So that's because I follow the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And that's the only reason I'm able to do what I do today is because God placed me in this fellowship. And he placed these steps and he placed you men in my life so that I would have something to stand on, something to look toward, something to work through, and a God who I knew was going to empower me one day. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we suffer from a disease from which only a spiritual experience is going to conquer. I didn't know that at the time. All I knew is that I had an insatiable appetite for booze, and I couldn't stop drinking one day at a time. I had my first drink when I was 8 years old. My parents used to host club meetings at our house, and me and my brother's job after the club meetings were to pick up the cups, take them to the sink, empty them, throw the cups in the trash can. Pick up the cups off the table, pour the contents in the sink, throw the cups in the trash can. Well, one evening, I picked up the cup, and there was some red-looking, Kool-Aid-looking drink in the cup. I picked up the cup, I walked to the sink, but before I poured it out, I turned the contents of it up. And about 20, 30 minutes later, man, it was just amazing. And so some of my mother's friends were trying to get me to dance at that point. And I think I kind of gotten a buzz, whatever the contents was in that drink. Now, I'm a fourth generation drunk. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my daddy were all alcoholics. My great-grandfather was born before Alcoholics Anonymous came to be. But my grandfather and my father both had an opportunity to come into this fellowship, but neither one of those great men found their way in here. Great men. Great men. I knew them both very well. Now, my grandfather and my father were both chronic alcoholics, but they were the happy kind of drunks, you know. They didn't do a lot of fighting and this kind of stuff, but they gave everything away once they got drunk. And I don't know what's worse, you know. And so I said, I don't want to be like my dad. I love my dad, but I didn't like him, and I really didn't like the fact that he named me after him. Somebody asked me earlier today, said, Smith, I've known you for a lot of years, and I've never known your real name. What is your real name? Well, I'm going to tell you a little later on. But anyway, I didn't want my father's name because I particularly didn't like the name. And so in high school, I kind of got the moniker Smitty, which when your last name is Smith, that, you know, they kind of stick that on you sometimes. And so don't remember drinking anything else from 8 years old up until the time I got about 12 years old. And we started, you know, experimenting with beer and that kind of stuff. And I drank beer for the first time. And I was one of those guys where, you know, I hear a lot of guys say when they first tasted beer, they didn't like the taste. I mean, it was just kind of neutral to me. It wasn't bad. It wasn't great. And I don't remember feeling a whole lot the very first time I drank it. But it was shortly after that we kind of got into some different potions, you know, and some wines and some this kind of stuff. And I can remember the very first time I got drunk, and the guys I got drunk with, they all threw up. But I didn't throw up. Now, I don't know if that was a harbinger of things to come or not, but I can remember I had been drinking about 4 or 5 years before I ever got sick from drinking. And it was because I mixed brown whiskey and white whiskey. And so I had to learn how to drink. And I was a fast learner. So I drank my way through high school without a whole bunch of problems. There were also some pharmaceuticals and that kind of thing, too. But in the fall of 1978, I entered Morehouse College. And they did a lot of drinking up there on the campus. They did a lot of, you know, and I began getting in trouble because of my drinking. And I remember getting called to the president's office at that time. The president was Hugh Gloucester. And he called me to the office, and I'll never forget him sitting down. He said, Mr. Smith, there's been a problem. And I said, sir, he said, I understand you've been over Spelman harassing our sisters. I said, no, sir, I was just over there. Mr. Smith, this is the third time, and this is the final time. You're banned from Spelman. If we see you over there on the campus again, sir, it's going to result in suspension. I said, okay, I won't go over to Spelman. And so drank my way and drug my way through. I was a broadcast management major, and I had some hopes one day of going into radio. And I started experiencing consequences from my drinking around that time. And my senior year at Morehouse, there was a radio job in New Orleans that was coming open. And the program manager from that radio station in New Orleans came up to the campus, and they were doing interviews for this position down in New Orleans. And so it was me, and there was a sister over at Spelman who were the last two finalists for this radio job. And so we had our interviews here, and the program director of that radio station says, I want to fly you both down to New Orleans, and you're going to meet with the program manager, program director, and then we'll make our determinations after that. You all got your plane tickets. You'll be flying out that Friday. And that Thursday night, I took drunk. I never made it to New Orleans. And the young lady who did had an incredible career in radio and wound up being one of the top DJs on the planet, you know, and I was so much better than she was. So I started experiencing consequences right away, and I can remember my first almost DUI. Almost. I never got a DUI. There's two things you have to get a DUI. You have to have a drunk person and a car. I didn't have a car. So, I kind of took care of all that. But I did borrow a car one night, and I was coming from Cobb County back over to Fulton County right there on Mableton Parkway, right there at Charlie Brown Airport. You know, there's a bridge that takes you from Cobb County. You cross over the bridge, you're back in Fulton County. And I was getting home, and I had that one eye closed because it was one of them kind of nights, you know. And just as I got ready to hit that bridge, lights came up in the back. And I've been preparing for this moment for years. I said, because I know one day I'm going to get stopped. I know what I'm going to do because I'm going to be able to talk my way out of this DUI. And, you know, I'm ready. And, I have my spit. So the lights came up. I said, okay, here we go. And so he walked up to the car, rolled the window down. And he said, do you know why I stopped you? I said, no. He said, have you been drinking? And I looked. He said, have you been drinking? And I said, what a guy to boo. He said, get out of the car. So he gave me the little field sobriety test, you know. He had my driver's license in his hand. He said, is this where you live? I said, yes, sir. You live right here? I said, yes, sir. He said, can you make it home? I said, yes, sir. He said, okay. He said, if I ever see you drinking up here in Cobb County ever again, and if I find you drinking and you've been driving and you've been drinking like this, you're going to jail. So he handed me my driver's license back. Now, this had to be around 1985, 1986. And I rolled my window up. I cranked the car, and just as I get ready to pull off, he knocked on the window. He wanted down. I rolled my window down. He said, I'm going to follow you home. And so he followed me down Maplewood Parkway across Fulton Industrial Boulevard up MLK Drive right on Fairman Road into Fairman Townhouse Apartments. And he turned around the middle of the street and went the other way. I said, when I pulled into that apartment complex, I am never drinking again. I'm never doing that again. And before the night was over, of course, I was drunk. So after school, I took a job with the transit company in Atlanta, MARTA. And it's a great place to work, but they had a problem with you driving the company vehicles drunk, you know? And I didn't see what the big deal was, but, you know. So in 1988, early November 1988, one of my friends was getting married up in Washington, D.C. area. And some of us didn't have the money to go to the wedding. Some of us didn't. And we decided we'd throw him a bachelor party the night before he took off that Friday morning for his wedding. So we did the doggone thing that Thursday night, man. We did it. And so that Friday morning, I had to go to work, which is no big deal. I stayed up all night a lot of times getting drunk and high and then made it for work the next morning. So, but I had this little routine that I would do when I would stay up all night hitting and all kind of stuff on the way into work. I stopped by this convenience store, I'd get me a quarter bill, you know, to take the edge off. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go on into work. Well, that morning, I was running a little late and I didn't stop at the store to get my quarter bill. So I went right around to work. And one of the female supervisors who had it in for me said she smelled booze on my breath that morning. And just as I got ready to pull out of my company vehicle, she knocked on my door. I have a bad problem with people knocking on my window. And she said, the director wants to see you in his office before you leave. And there was a feeling of gloom and doom that came over me, the likes I had never experienced in my life. And I walked into that office, and I stood at the door, and he said, Mrs. Smith, have you been drinking? And I said, well, I had a little something last night. He said, last night, he said, I can smell you from the door. Now, I was probably about 8 feet from his desk where I was standing at the door. He said, I cannot let you go out in that vehicle in your condition. He said, and as a matter of fact, you're going to be suspended until we determine whether or not you have, you know, illegally drunk, and so you have to go down for a drug test. Uh-oh. And this was in 1988 before they had like zero. How many of y'all got zero tolerance policies on your job? If they catch you before you go tell them you got a problem, it's over, you know. Well, this was before then. And so I said, okay. So I had to give them my keys and my pass and all that kind of stuff, and we'll call you when the test results come back. So I guess a week or so, the test results call back. I get a call from the office. We need to meet with you. And so I came to the office. And so at that time, what they would do, they would ask you if you had a problem. If you had a problem and you wanted to get some help, you told them yes, they'd give you some help. But if you told them no, it relieved the company of any, you know, accountability for your recovery whatsoever. Smitty, do you have a drug problem? I said, no. He said, okay, well, we're going to read the test results back. You blew or whatever it was into the breathalyzer in your system. We found marijuana. We found cocaine, Fruit Loops, shoe polish, Clorox, everything. Do you have a drug problem? I said, no. They say, well, you hereby relieved of your duties here at the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. Good luck to you, sir, and we'll see you when we see you. And I said, these ungrateful SOBs, I have put all this time in on this job. I gave them quality work. I showed up every day. You know, I didn't have an attendance problem at all because I got high and drunk at work, you know. So I never... Well, my termination papers came across the desk of the union representative at the time, who was a golfing buddy of my stepdad. So he violated my anonymity and called my stepdad and said, we just got Smitty's termination papers. What's going on? Well, so my stepdad said, termination? What do you mean? So naturally, he calls me. You just got fired? I was like, no, I just got terminated, you know. So he took it upon himself to make a couple phone calls. So the next thing I know, I'm getting this call from the director of my department. Can we meet with you? We want to talk about you being reinstated. I said, it's about time. And so I had a meeting set up with them at the headquarters building, and I had to be out there, you know, whatever the time was, and I got out there, and, you know, they sit and talk, and they say, well, Smitty, listen, we went over your files, we saw you never had attendance record, you're not late for work, you know, put good work in, except for this blemish on your record, and we want to give you another opportunity to get your job back. Now, we are offering you an opportunity to go to drug rehabilitation for 30 days inpatient, after which time we'll reassess the situation depending on how you do in this 30-day inpatient rehabilitation, and we will then, you know, subsequently reinstate you if we feel like you've been successful in this, you know, recovery endeavor. Well, do you accept our offer? I said, no, because I don't have a drug problem. So he said, well, listen, before you make such a important decision, can you just talk to some of your friends and family members? Because we think this is going to be a good deal, not just for you, but also for the authority. You're a great employee, and we want to be able to retain you, but more importantly, we want you to get the help you need. And that's when God began doing for me what I could not do for myself, because I made a couple of phone calls. One of the phone calls I made was to my mother. One of the phone calls I made was to the brother I lived with, and the other phone call I made was to the young lady I was dating at the time. And it was like they knew I was going to call. And they all said, go, go. If they're offering you some help, go. So the guy called back that day and he said, so what's your decision going to be? I said, I'm going to go. He said, okay, we need you out here at 12 o'clock noon today. Not 11:59, not 12:01. We need you here at noon. If you're not here at noon, the deal is off. And so I went out there and I met with the EAP guy, the Employee Assistance Program Coordinator. And I talked with him about my drinking and my using. And for the first time that I can remember, I was honest with somebody about how I used. And I don't know why I was so honest with this guy. And so after we had our talk, he said, well, listen, this is what we're going to do. He had all these beautiful colorful pamphlets on the table about all these great treatment centers, and they were all over the country. I had an opportunity to get sober in California near the beach, and I could have gotten sober out in Colorado in the Rocky Mountains. I could have gotten sober in Arizona in the desert, and I chose Smyrna, Georgia. And so he said, okay, well, I'm going to call this place out here in Smyrna, and if they have a bed for you, we'll go from there. So he called the guy. The guy said, yeah, we got a bed. He said, okay, so they're going to be looking for you tonight at 7 o'clock. I said, ho, ho, ho. They're going to be looking for me when? He said, tonight, 7 o'clock. I said, oh, no, I can't possibly go tonight. Because I have some things. I have some things that, you know, need to, you know, some things I need to tie up before I make that commitment, you know. He said, Smith, everything you own is in your pocket. He said, don't worry about it. Take a change of clothes and be out there at 7 o'clock. Not 6:59, not 7:01. If you cannot be there at 7 o'clock tonight, the intake person out there is going to call me and this deal is going to be off. So there I was about 3:30 in the afternoon. I had to be out there at 7 o'clock. I left his office. One of the first things I did, I went downstairs, got on a payphone. I called my brother. I said, listen, I got to turn myself in at 7 o'clock. I said, we got about 2.5 good hours. I said, you know what we got to do, right? Brother said, we'll be ready when you get here. You know. So I got home, man, it was on. We had everything, man. It was laid out. It was like a going away party. We had crack cocaine snowballs. I mean, we was like, it was crazy. So I had drank myself into a blackout, and it was time for me to go to the place. So at 6:30, my cousin drove me in his car out to Smyrna, and we got there about 10 minutes to 7. And so I said, we still got 10 minutes. And so we sat in the parking lot of Ridgeview Institute, and we finished it off, baby. And so I got out of the car, and I walked in the blackout. And that's the last thing I remember for 1.5 days. I don't remember anything. So when I came to, it was the next day and a half, and it was dark. And I remember this guy had a flashlight in my eye. And he was a big old football. He was a big old white guy. And he had my arm. And when I came to, he had the flashlight in my hand, my arm in his other hand. He said, I'm here to take your vitals. Now, at the time, I didn't know what my vitals were. But I know I didn't want him taking them at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so, the next day, I kind of came to, and I decided, at the time I was trying to like smoke cigarettes, I had a package crumpled up, Newports in my pocket. And I asked the guy, I said, can you open the door? I want to go out and smoke. And he looked at me, he's like, you can't leave. I was like, I can't leave. He said, no, you can't leave. You're in detox. I was like, detox? He said, yeah, we'll let you know when you can leave. If you want to go smoke, there's a patio that you can go to. And so that's where it began. Now, I didn't know what this whole deal was about, and I heard a lot of talk, and there were people at different stages of their recovery, and they had this little thing they called a rubber room. And they told me, whatever you do, you don't want to go to the rubber room. And so, But that's where it began. I began going to these sessions and therapy sessions and all this kind of stuff. And I was talking to people. I met one guy who said this. I've been to treatment 16 times. This is my 16th, I said 16 times. I said, wow. And there was one girl who had a seizure while she was in there. And it was just all kinds of stuff going on. And it was at that time that God began doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Now, I didn't really know if I wanted to get clean, but what I did want more than anything was to get that job back. Mm. And that was my motivation at the time. Now, there were some people who were praying for me, without my permission. There were some folk who were, doing some things for me that I didn't give them authority to do outside of that, but I didn't know that. All I know, I was in this place, and next thing I know, a week went by, 2 weeks went by, and I spent my Thanksgiving that year in treatment. So I walked in there on the 20th of November, 1988. So they let me know that the 21st was my clean date, and because that was the first day that I had not used. But they were drug testing me for 2 weeks, and residue from my using was still showing up in my bloodstream. So it was almost 3 weeks before I took a test, and nothing was showing up. And so it was about that time, it was getting close to Christmas, and I was excited because my potential release date was going to be like a few days before Christmas. And I guess like a week before Christmas, I had an intervention with the staff because they didn't feel like I was being serious about this recovery thing. Every time we see you, you're smiling and grinning and laughing with everybody, and we don't feel like you're serious. And if you're not getting this up to our expectations, we may have to hold you a little longer. I got serious like a mug. So the next intervention, they decided that I could leave, but they were strongly suggesting that I go into, they called it a halfway house. And I said, what's a halfway house? They say, well, the halfway house is where you're going to a recovering community with other men, and you'll be in an apartment. There'll be 12 of y'all in an apartment. And I was like, oh, no, I can't do that. They say, well, we are strongly suggesting it, and we'll be talking with the EAP coordinator at MARTA, and we'll let him know about your disdain for this halfway house. And I said, well, is there anything else I can do? And he said, yeah, well, there's an outpatient deal, but it's 11 weeks. You have to go 4 nights a week, and on the nights you don't go, you have to get a documented 12-step meeting. And I said, 4 nights a week. Yeah, you have to be there from 6 to 9 o'clock, 4 nights a week. And I'm like, and the alternative is going to live with 12 guys for 6 months. I said, I'll take the outpatient for $200. And so it began. Now, the young lady I was dating at the time was in school, and she was getting her master's degree, and so I did not have a car, remember? And so I had to get to Windy Hill Road from the west side of Atlanta by 6. She had to be in class at 6, which means I had to use her car, take her down to Georgia State, drop her off, beat it up to Windy Hill Road, finish my class. Her class was over at 9:30 at night, so this went on for 11 weeks. And I was sick of it. But what started happening in the meantime is I started learning about why I use like I use. I started going to meetings. I started hearing things I'd never heard before. I heard people talking about you never have to use one day at a time. I heard that there's a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is for chronic alcohol abusers. People who can't stop drinking have found a new way of life. Then I started going to meetings in other fellowships, and I started hearing the same message, and they told me I needed to get a sponsor. And I said, well, what's a sponsor? He said, it's a person who's going to help you work the 12 steps. And once you get one of those people, you're going to find somebody who, you know, who you hear maybe in a meeting sharing, and you like what they shared, and you can ask that person to be your sponsor. So my very first sponsor, I heard him sharing in a meeting. I liked what he shared, but I picked him because he drove this nice Porsche convertible. And I wanted what he had. Well, it turns out that guy was selling hot merchandise out of that nice convertible Porsche. And he got locked up. So my very first sponsor didn't work out too well. So I started going to other meetings. And I remember the very first time I went to the heavy hitters meeting. And I think I had about, I may have had about 6 months. And I went one time and I didn't like it. Because they were talking mean.
Shut up.
I didn't like it. They were telling guys to shut up. Sit down and shut up. You're going to make coffee. You're going to sweep the floor. You're gonna... I say, oh, no, I won't be back over here. So I didn't go back for a while. But in the meantime, I started hearing these messages of how I could live. And this young lady that I've been dating just kind of fell in line. And, you know, we started going to meetings together. And she was in support. She started going to Al-Anon. And she was, like, getting this whole thing. She said, you know, this is pretty incredible. It's been almost a year and you haven't taken a drink. And I said, will you marry me? And she said, you got to be crazy. They told you that you shouldn't make any major changes for a whole year. When you get 2 years sober, we can talk about getting married then. And by the grace of God, one day at a time, we got married in September of 1990. I would have been 2 years sober in November of 1990. We had an incredible wedding, and you know, and we began that path of sobriety. You know, she had hers, I had mine, and things just started happening. I just didn't understand it, man. I know a lot of people had a really rough go in their first attempts at sobriety, man, but it was just like something really exciting was going on, and we had found like this underground society that nobody knew about, and we were going, shh, enough. We're going to meetings, and we was doing a thing, man. And my credit was so jacked up at the time, and I was so focused on getting my stuff back. And she sat down with me one night. She said, listen, this is what we're going to do. You need to write all your creditors a letter. I said, write them a letter? She said, yeah. She said, I was listening in one of my meetings that you can't just ignore your responsibilities. And if you want to marry me, then we're going to have to get this straight right now. So all three of my creditors, I wrote them a letter. All three of them. And I think what I owe total was probably $1,000, okay? And you're going to let them know that you're going to send them $10 a month every month until you pay those debts off. And I did that, and all those creditors wrote me back and said, we'll accept the terms of that. And I did that. And so she had this particular credit card, and they allowed you to get a secondary card on that account. And she gave me one. She said, I want you to go buy a shirt this month, and I want you to pay it off. Next month, I want you to buy a pair of pants. You're going to pay them off. Next month, buy something. And so all the while, I'm going to meetings, and I liked some of them. Some of them I didn't. Then I got this guy, I'm a sponsor, and he was telling me all the different kind of meetings he wanted me to go to. He said, you're going to have to go to a men's meeting. You're going to go to a speaker meeting. You're going to go to a beginner's meeting. And I didn't like them speaker meetings. Mm-hmm. I didn't like them speaker meetings because they talked too long, and everybody was laughing, and I didn't like that kind of stuff. And I didn't like the men's meetings, but I liked the meetings where the women were, man. I liked them. Yeah. And I asked him, I said, well, why do I have to go to these men meetings? And he was like, so you won't have the distractions. He said, right now I need you to hear the message, and I don't want you getting distracted by these beautiful ladies in recovery. And I said, well, thank you. And so it kind of began like that, man, and I don't know what took place. I just did what they told me to do, and I know I'm a program guy, and I'm not a real big book thumper, but I've been thumped by the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the program that works for me. Alcoholics Anonymous was not set to fix everything that's wrong with me, and I know that because I still got some junk. You know, some days I just ain't right, man. And so, but the things that were wrong with me, Alcoholics Anonymous showed me one day at a time with the help of a loving God how to deal with that stuff. I have come in here and I've watched men go through some incredible stuff. I watched men lose marriages. I watched men lose fortunes. I've seen some men lose their lives. But I watch men come in here, stand tall and stand strong, and they get this program, and I see them lead incredible lives. And I want that. That's what I wanted. And there came a point in time where that sponsor asked me, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety? And I said, yeah. He said, well, let's go to work. We got in those steps, man, and we didn't do a whole bunch of fluff and a whole bunch of muff. We did it the way the book says do it. And I'm here to tell you, man, I'm a program guy because I got one white chip. Right. And I'm just a crackhead from the west side of Atlanta. And I don't have to make apologies about saying I got one chip. I used to tell my sponsor, well, you know, I don't like saying that because I don't want to make anybody say, man, people need to hear that message. Yes. Relapse is a part of this disease, but it's not a necessary one. He said, people need to hear that message. That's right. People need to know that you're a married man and you've never had to cheat on your wife the entire time that you've been married. They need to hear that message. Mm. People need to know that you're a responsible father and you did those things. They need to hear those kinds of things. We hear enough of the other stuff in every meeting. Mm-hmm. But they need to hear this message. You ain't better than nobody. You're a program guy. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the big book. It's laid out. I didn't have to think about anything. The book says the purpose of this book is to show others precisely how we have recovered. And they didn't deviate from that, man. I had some guys who were loving and they were patient and they were kind, but they didn't let me deviate from that commitment I made to go to any lengths for my sobriety. And so now here I am, 28 years later. Yeah. That job that fired me, I retired from it in 2014. Now, the last 6 years that I worked for MARTA, you know, bus operators and train operators have a yearly drug screen they have to take on their birthday. They know when it's coming. And some of them still couldn't pass it. And so when they could have, they would refer these guys to me and a couple other people for counseling because they knew I'd had some success. You know, when you know the test is coming and you can't pass it. And so I got initiated into service work in an indirect way that I had no intention of doing. But it worked. And the book tells us, if you want to ensure your sobriety, your recovery, whatever you want to call it, you gotta serve, man. That's right. You gotta serve, man. Right, yeah. You know, you can do it any way you want. Alcoholics Anonymous does not force anybody to work its program. Whatever works for you, work that. But for this drunk, it was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that worked for me. That wife who said that she would never marry me, she walked, guess it, proudly down that aisle in 1990, married the crackhead, and they don't live happily ever after. They had a son in 1995. And my son is now a senior at Kennesaw State University, getting ready to graduate with a degree in communications, and he's minoring in Spanish. He's fluent in Spanish. The church he goes to, he acts as interpreter for the church. The church is in a heavily Hispanic community. And so he goes out and he interprets for the church. Now, my son has had my permission to break my anonymity all his life. I can remember when Austin was about 4 years old, we were at a restaurant one night. You know, so the server comes around, they want to tell you all the drink specials first. We have this so-and-so, you have the pina colada, we have this margarita, and Austin said, my daddy don't drink, he an alcoholic. But he's a program baby. When he was in the crib, man, I picked that joker up and take him. You know, Lisa was traveling at the time, man, and I pick him up in that car seat, and we go to a meeting. I sit down, and he'd cry. I stick the bottle in his mouth, and half the meeting I cry, he'd give me the bottle. I mean, you know, so he just, you know, that's what worked for us, you know. And so now I have a son who's never seen his daddy drunk a day in his life. Now, he's seen his dad do some really irresponsible, stupid things. But drinking is not one of them. But one day, somebody's going to push a beer across the table at my son, and he's going to have to make a decision. He's going to have to make that decision based off what he's seen his daddy do for these 21 years of his life, the meetings he goes to, the guys who wake up in his house sometimes on the sofa that he does not know their names. That's what he's seen all his life. But he knows the day that I don't drink. That mother-in-law who told her daughter, don't marry him. Today, I'm the guy that gives her medication every day. I'm the guy that handles her checking account. I'm the guy who drives her to doctor's appointments. I'm the guy who makes sure that she's okay, her and her 93-year-old husband. I'm that guy. And I'm that guy because God's grace and because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, listen. This is my story, Sherlock. I got this. So,
he's gonna share behind you.
So this is a program of lost and found. Let me tell you two things that I lost. I lost some incredible friendships because of my youth. I lost some great career opportunities because of my youth. There's some friends that I don't have anymore because they would not accept my amends when it was time to do that. I lost a lot of things. But let me tell you some things I found. I found now I don't have to do stupid stuff like go over to the pawn shop on Peter Street and look at my mama's jewelry through the window. One of my mother's friends was a merchant seaman, and he had been over into the Mediterranean somewhere, and he brought my mother these two beautiful 18-karat gold-top salt and pepper shakers. The salt in it was from the Mediterranean, and the pepper was from somewhere in Spain, and he brought them to her as a gift. All I heard was 18 karat gold. So one night when my mother was asleep, I took that salt and pepper shaker over to the pawn shop on Peter Street. And I asked the guy, what could I get for that? He looked at him, he said, what is this? I said, that salt and pepper shaker is from the Mediterranean. I said, this pepper is from Spain. The salt is from the Mediterranean. The tops of these salt and pepper shakers are 18 karat gold. What can I get from them? He said, you can get the hell out of my pawn shop. So I lost doing stupid, irresponsible things like that. My wife, when we were dating, I hated all her friends. So my wife had this apartment at one point, and she used to invite her friends over. And she would like me to mix drinks for her friends. Well, all her friends that I did not like, I had a special mixture for them. She had this really nice bar that's set up like this. And so I would mix their drinks behind the bar, and I would insert my products into their drinks.
My man.
So when the time came for me to make amends, I asked my sponsor, so should I tell my wife about this?
He said, absolutely not.
And that's the thing about having a sponsor. He said, there is a fine line between honesty and stupidity. He said, you will not stir any more drinks for anyone else. And that will be the amend you make in that regard. And so I'm grateful and thankful today for the things that I lost, for the things that I found, but the things that I found have been so much greater. Alvin was right. I live a life today beyond my wildest imaginations. It's not about the stuff, man. It's about the peace. It's about the fact that I've been married to a beautiful woman for 26 years, faithfully. I have been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. I have an incredible life today, and I get to live it how I want to live it. I'm retired. I'm up every day at the crack of noon. And, you know, I love it. I love it. I love it. And I get to serve how I want to serve today. But it's so much more than being a sober man today. It's the fact that I'm not enslaved to my addictions anymore. My addictions ran everything I do. Narcotics Anonymous said we live to use and use to live. Very simply, and that is a man and woman whose life is controlled by drugs. And that was my life. Today, the only thing that controls me is the God of my understanding today and the 12 principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are the steps. Now, you're going to hear a lot of stuff about a particular principle being a higher step. And listen, the spiritual principles are the steps themselves. And there's an essence, if you want to say to every step, that's fine. But the spiritual principles are the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want this program and you want it to its full, there's no way of getting around it. You have the choice to do this program however you want to do it. But if you want a life that's happy, joyous, and free, and full of service, and gratitude, and humility, and you get rid of self-centeredness and all that other stuff, there's no way around working the steps, man. There's no way around it. You do it like you want to do it. But I'm talking about the way this worked for me. Alcoholics Anonymous says in the big book, we don't hold a monopoly on people getting sober. But I know for a fact this is the way that's worked for the great majority of us. So I'm very grateful. So let me tell you about this name thing. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I've had the name Smitty for a while now. My real name is Robert Maurice Smith. And I came in here, and my dad's name was Bobby Smith. And when I came into AA and found like one of the founders' name was Bob Smith, I was like, you got to be kidding me, right? And I just knew that that was like much bigger than him just being named Bob Smith. And I said, wow, this is just phenomenal. So I've had little things like that happen all through my life, man, in these 28 years. But the thing I appreciate more today is watching new men and women come into this fellowship. And, right. And you see them. You know, you'll get them little 30-day hug from somebody, you know, and they hug you, you know. I see it all, man, and I get experience it all. But if you want this program to the full, man, jump in. Jump in, man. It's not going to hurt you, I promise you. It'll help you. Workshops like this, I'm so grateful for and thankful for. I'm so excited about this weekend, and I thank you guys for giving me the opportunity, you know, to come and serve. But you know, if you're having some reservations about it, don't, man. Come and see me after the meeting. We'll talk. Because I know somebody's out there right now saying, this is not for me. I said the same thing, this is not for me. I thought AA was a towing service when I first came in. They told me I had to go to AA. But listen, I love you guys, man. Have a great weekend. Thanks.